The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Building a Better Banana, How NC Biotech Firms Are Redesigning the Future of Agriculture. And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Smarter Food, North Carolina Ag Tech Firms Work to Develop More Resilient Plants. The world's most popular type of banana is heading toward extinction. A soil fungus is attacking the Cavendish banana variety that dominates grocery store shelves, and it is a threat that is only worsening as warmer temperatures and more severe storms have allowed the fungus to establish itself in places not previously affected. The plants are facing more and more of a threat, and we feel it on the fields, said Todd Rand, CEO of ELO Life Systems, that's spelled E-L-O. Agriculture is on the front lines of the war against climate change, he says. ELO is a biotechnology company in Research Triangle Park that is tackling challenges related to food and agriculture through molecular farming. Essentially, the company is identifying ingredients in nature that can be created and introduced to other plants to solve specific problems. With the banana, for instance, ELO is exploring the near and distant relatives of the Cavendish and other plant species to find natural resources, natural sources of resistance against the fungus. After identifying those sources, the company, through gene editing, makes changes to the Cavendish with the aim of creating the same resistance to the fungus. The genetic scissors can come in and make those one or two changes and take that natural change that was already out there and allow that same change to exist in the crop we care about, Rand said. ELO, or ELO, is one of many companies in the Triangle area leveraging different high-tech tools to tackle some of the world's most pressing challenges affecting the crops that farmers grow and the food that people eat. Farmers and growers are facing pressure to increase productivity to feed an ever-growing global population at a time when resources are becoming more constrained, such as the loss of cropland due to urbanization or a shortage in basic fertilizer materials. Further complicating the situation is a changing climate, the effects of which can be seen in North Carolina and elsewhere globally. Researchers at local universities and companies are working on technology that could be crucial to solving these challenges, said Adrian Percy, executive director of the North Carolina Plant Sciences Initiative at NC State University. This is not a thing that's just in North Carolina. This is much, much bigger, Percy said. And I think that the ag innovation ecosystem that we have here will certainly benefit North Carolina, but will also have impacts nationally and globally that really is an enormous opportunity for us. Establishing roots. From apple orchards in the mountains to vineyards in the center of the state and tobacco and sweet potatoes in the east, North Carolina is one of the most agricultural diverse states in the U.S., Percy said. North Carolina is also one of the top producing states. Cash receipts from all commodities grown in North Carolina exceeded $15 billion in 2023, which was behind just eight other states, according to data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. With its history as one of the country's top crop producers, North Carolina has long been home to companies focused on the food and agriculture industries. This includes large organizations like Bayer, which used to have its U.S. headquarters for its crop science division in RTP before relocating it to St. Louis, and companies such as BASF and Syngenta, which continue to have significant operations in the Triangle. The presence of these large corporations, although it has diminished, plus recent college graduates from the Triangle's prominent research universities, creates a deep talent pool that supports the growth of local agriculture tech companies. One such company is Avalo, spelled A-V-A-L-O, founded in 2020 around technology out of Duke University. CEO Brendan Collins and Chief Scientific Officer Mariano Alvarez first connected over a beer at a brewery in Durham, where they talked about Alvarez's ongoing postdoc research at Duke. Alvarez, an evolutionary biologist and a computational geneticist, was looking at how plants adapt to changing environmental conditions. Alvarez said he spent a lot of his time focused on identifying the genetic basis of climate-responsive traits in plants. Collins and Alvarez thought about how this work could be used in the real world, initially with a focus on human health, which was later shifted to agriculture. Agriculture is all-encompassing and touches people's lives in a way that permeates, and it doesn't get as much attention as biotech human health, Alvarez said. Avalo, who was formed as a seed and agriculture product company that uses computational biology to run its own breeding programs to create new seeds for crops with specific climate-resilient traits. After spinning out of Duke, Avalo in 2021 joined an accelerator in San Francisco and raised a pre-seed funding round, followed later that year by a $3 million seed round. In total, the company has raised about $16 million since forming, which includes a Series A that closed earlier this year. After the accelerator, the company thought about remaining in San Francisco to be near major venture capital investors and also considered St. Louis because of the area's significant agriculture ecosystem, but ultimately the startup returned to North Carolina. This was partially due to the biotechnology talent coming out of local universities, but Avalo also saw the benefit of being in an area that historically had a major concentration on some of the world's largest agriculture companies. There were a lot of mergers and changes going on at some of these bigger companies, and many of them were moving operations, not pulling out completely, but reducing their footprint in the area, and that left this infrastructure sitting around that we thought might be useful for us to take advantage of, Alvarez said. When BASF, which maintains its North American headquarters for its agricultural solutions business in the Triangle, closed a local facility a few years ago, the company auctioned specialized equipment, such as plant growth chambers and seed counting machines. Avalo was able to purchase crucial equipment at a much lower cost. The young company of 17 employees was also able to pull in some of the people who had left BASF with decades worth of experience. Everybody has had a presence here, Alvarez says. I didn't have this perception of the Triangle before, but now that I'm working in this industry, it's a place that everybody in ag has looked into because historically there's so much concentration of stuff here from the big companies. There are more than 190 agriculture and food technology companies in North Carolina, ranging from large corporations to small startups, but the industry has room for even further growth, Percy said. Campus connections. Two keys to support additional growth include bringing in additional investment funding and reinforcing North Carolina's brand as a top hub for these industries compared to places like Boston or Silicon Valley. The latter is a major focus area for Percy's work at NC State's Plant Sciences Initiative, which in 2022 opened a brand new 185,000 square foot facility at the university's Centennial Campus. NC State built the facility with the help of multiple North Carolina commodity groups to be an interdisciplinary hub for research happening throughout the university. This includes bringing together the ideas of engineering and biology researchers to tackle problems such as how to make crops more resilient to a changing climate. Some of this research is supported by government grants, and some of it comes from other sources. Jude Simulski, a pioneer of the Triangle's gene therapy industry and co-founder of AskBio, recently gave the university a $3 million endowment to launch a center focused on using gene editing technology to modify plants for various purposes, such as improving climate resiliency. The building also has an incubator space for startups with ties to the university. This gives smaller companies like Elysia Creative Biology access to lab and greenhouse space, which otherwise could be hard to come by. North Carolina agriculture is pretty representative of many different types of agricultural systems around the world. The stuff that we do here with North Carolina growers in mind also benefits growers across the nation, but also overseas, Percy said. Advancing innovation. Eli Hornstein did not set out for a career in agriculture or biotechnology. He was originally trained in conservation. I was the guy who went out to some park in some exotic country and was on the ground counting animals and seeing if things were working, Hornstein said. But during that work, what Hornstein found was that improving the sustainability of some of these places would not be possible without first addressing challenges in agriculture. The industry is one of the world's largest land and water users, and in the U.S. it is responsible for about 10% of the annual greenhouse gas emissions. So Hornstein set out to find a way to push for rapid changes in agriculture and pursued a doctorate degree at NC State's Department of Plant and Microbial microbial biology. Hornstein's postdoc research led to the formation of his startup, Elysia Creative Biology, focused on using genetic engineering to create feed crops that suppress the methane emitted by cows and farm animals. This is already being done in some ways. Researchers have found that feeding seaweed to cattle can reduce carbon emissions. In that situation, it is not the seaweed itself that is suppressing methane, but rather a specific compound found in the seaweed. These seaweed additives work, but this process creates another expense for farmers who already operate on thin margins. Hornstein's company wants to take a different approach. Elysia is pursuing ways to add compounds and enzymes directly into feed crops that can either suppress methane or capture carbon. If we can make methane mitigation convenient, so not just effective, but really easy for farmers to do, that would be the key to actually getting this wide adoption, Hornstein said. Farmers are already feeding corn to cows or letting them graze, so we just give them a new plant. This focus on convenience is key to Avalo's commercial strategies, too. The startup is working on a project with growers in Texas to develop a new cotton variety that can thrive in warmer and drier summers. Texas cotton in a good year can comprise about 70% of all U.S. cotton. In a bad year, this number can drop below 25%, Alvarez said. To find a solution, Avalo looks to all the known varieties of cotton, including ones that grow wild in nature, without irrigation in incredibly warm temperatures. Our hypothesis here is these farmers need something different than what they've been growing for the past 10 years, Alvarez said. Let's see if we can bring some of those wild traits back into domesticated varieties and give them something that's a little bit hardier in the growing conditions that they have now. To create a new cotton variety, the company sequences the genomes of different plants and takes this genetic data and runs it through a machine learning model that can predict how plants will perform given specific genetic combinations. The company then takes this information and crossbreeds wild and high-performing domestic cotton varieties in a greenhouse to eventually produce seeds with new genetic combinations. Avalo again sequences those seeds and runs the data through the company's machine learning model that identifies which seeds are going to perform how the company wants. We take those seeds and we grow them back out in Texas, Alvarez said. We run that cycle 3 times a year, so we get about 9 generations over 3 years, and at the end of those 9 generations, we have a variety that we're ready to release. In addition to cotton, Avalo is working on projects involving tomatoes and broccoli, and has been approached by a soda bottling company to look at sugar crops. Alvarez and his co-founder, Collins, first connected over a shared focus on environmental issues and sustainability. In agriculture, this can often mean more work and expenses for growers. Instead, Avalo is focused on tying sustainability to efficiency for growers. If we can go to the growers and say, we're going to give you a seed that is more consistent year over year because it's more climate resilient, they understand what that means, Alvarez says. They understand that for the next few years they're going to have predictable revenue, and that means predictable loan rates, and that means predictable equipment usages. Even when agriculture companies develop and bring new products to the market, the path to becoming a successful commercial operation can be difficult. For instance, AgBiome, a local startup formed in 2012, earlier this year shut down operations and sold off its assets, despite raising millions of dollars over about a decade and developing 2 commercial crop protection products. Agriculture is a difficult business for small companies to navigate. Part of the challenge is the industry's diversity, with farmers needing different solutions based on the crops they're growing, the local environment, and numerous other factors. Pairwise, a gene editing company focused on food and agriculture, recently pivoted on the commercial strategy for its first product. The company, through its gene editing platform, was able to remove the pungency of mustard greens and other leafy green varieties, essentially creating a salad mix that tastes more like lettuce but is more nutritious. Pairwise launched the product under the brand Conscious Greens last year in select restaurants. The company was beginning its transition into retail but ultimately decided to pivot. Instead, Pairwise earlier this year signed a deal with Bayer, which it has partnered with on research collaborations. That gives the latter the ability to license and commercialize 10 different leafy green varieties that Pairwise developed. This shift allows Pairwise to focus more on other projects in its pipeline. Earlier this year, the company unveiled a new seedless blackberry that is grown on a more compact plant without thorns, supporting more efficient fruit harvesting and improved productivity for growers. Instead of focusing exclusively on yield size and other traits that growers care about, Pairwise was formed with the aim of using genetic editing to make improved products for consumers as well, said CEO Tom Adams. This means improving the taste of mustard greens or removing the pits from cherries, another project in the pipeline. Making these consumer-facing changes could help drive consumption. Adams, as an example, cites the seedless mandarin oranges that are easy to peel. After those became readily available all year, it helped turn around a shrinking citrus industry. We want to make cherries into a year-round product without a pit, and we think that will drive consumption through the roof, Adams said. Finding space. Pairwise has its corporate headquarters in downtown Durham in a large facility with labs and greenhouse space in RTP. This available greenhouse space is part of what drew Pairwise to setting up operations in the Triangle. In the early days of forming the company, Adams said they considered locating in biotech hubs in Boston or California, but the process of navigating building regulations around constructing a greenhouse led the company to look elsewhere. At the same time, Pairwise was working on a research and development collaboration with Monsanto prior to Bayer acquiring the company. Adams, who previously worked at Monsanto, knew of the facility in RTP that the company had shut down a few years earlier. The facility had 25,000 square feet of greenhouse space and grow chambers, presenting Pairwise with an opportunity that was too good to pass up, Adams said. One of the smarter decisions we made was to come here, he said. The Triangle area has a reasonable amount of existing greenhouse space, Adams said, but one of the challenges for companies, especially younger ones, is to find a facility that fits their needs. Because of the way we started with significant funding, we were able to step in and actually utilize as much greenhouse space as we got, Adams said. But a lot of startup companies need 4,000 or 5,000 square feet, not 25,000 square feet. This is a challenge Hornstein is beginning to think about for Elysia, which is currently operating at the NC State Plant Sciences building, where the company has dedicated lab space and access to grow chambers and a greenhouse. Alexandria Real Estate Equities, which operates about 4 million square feet of space around RTP, is one of the only greenhouse providers in the area. Local universities, Duke, NC State, and UNC Chapel Hill, also operate greenhouses, but space is limited and mostly reserved for university researchers. Hornstein has looked into other options, including a potential site in Burlington called SCS Specialty Agriculture, which offers greenhouse space and other research services. Elysia, which has so far secured more than $1 million in mostly non-dilutive funds, has also kicked around the idea of building its own facility. When it's our time to leave for our current space, how we'll deal with growing is definitely a big question for us, Hornstein said. Depending on our finances at the time we make the jump, I've debated building a greenhouse. But this process can be expensive. It is something that Traitology CEO Fayez Kazi said his company evaluated before finding the space the company now occupies. Depending on the type of greenhouse, it can be a $10 million to $15 million investment for about 5,000 square feet. Instead of having to make this investment, Traitology was able to occupy the space that AgBiome vacated after the company shut down operations earlier this year. The company now has about 25,000 square feet of offices and laboratories and a 5,000 square foot greenhouse on TW Alexander Drive. The move was needed for Traitology, a company that formed in 2022, but unlike other startups, Traitology launched with immediate backing and a $25 million investment from one of the world's largest soybean genetics companies, GDM. We consider ourselves as a startup with an advantage, Kazi said. We're a research organization, but we're not doing research to further a technology or validate something. We're doing research to create new products in soybean and eventually corn and wheat. Traitology is a digital biology company that discovers and creates traits to develop new crop varieties. The company is focused on making improvements in soybeans, one of the most valuable crops in the world. This includes looking at ways to improve the yield of plants and also find ways to protect the yield under different types of stress. This includes pathogens, insects, fungus, and environmental factors. Aside from GDM's investment, Traitology has access to the company's genetics data developed over decades. Traitology can leverage this data to quickly develop new products in an industry where the pace of change has historically been slow. The complexity and the scale of agriculture is so big, you have to be a certain size to be able to think that you're going to make a difference, Kazi said. That's the core reason why we started Traitology the way we did, with the relationships that we have. If you truly want to make a difference in agriculture, you need to have all these players figured out. In addition to trying to save the banana, ELO is developing a sweetener that's derived from monk fruit, which grows in remote areas of China, making it difficult to access and harvest. Using molecular farming, ELO is taking the same ingredient from monk fruit and producing it in other crops that are easier to grow at scale. This includes developing a liquid form of its sweetener using watermelons and a powder version from sugar beets. ELO CEO Ran said the company is focused on reimagining the future of food. Since World War II, during which the goal was to increase production to feed as many people, agriculture systems have focused on establishing the infrastructure for brutal efficiencies, but Rand said this has led to other problems, such as negative impacts on the environment and human health. However, with advances in technology, there are new ways of trying to tackle these challenges. That's what all of these ag tech companies and RTP like ELO were all about, Rand said. We each have a part in that. There's not one of us that's going to bring all of that change. We're all jumping in and looking at ways technology can accelerate our momentum towards the goals that all of us are striving for. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by Dane Huffman. Why Charlotte's South End is sizzling, rail line provides a lift as a former gritty part of the Queen City thrives. In 1825, Samuel McCombs found gold nuggets on his land in Charlotte, near the current location of Bank of America Stadium. That set off a gold rush in the town and region, and thus the nickname, the UNC Charlotte 49ers. The area of town where McCombs first swung an axe turned industrial and stayed that way for a century and a half, but now it's experiencing a gold rush all its own again. Charlotte's once gritty South End, turbocharged by the opening of light rail in 2007, has become a magnet for young professionals seeking their fortune in the city. And it provides a keen example of what the thoughtful investment can do for a city. South End is just southwest of uptown Charlotte, the area around the corner of South and East Streets. As recently as 1996, it had 100 vacant properties, according to Charlotte Center City Partners. Much like Raleigh's Glenwood South, it emerged as an epicenter of young life in the city. Creative types were first attracted to the area by lower rents, and restaurants and bars followed. By 2012, there were 5,010 people living in the area, the Charlotte Group reports. Now, though, the number has surged to 13,000 with an average age of 30, and the area has a whopping 9,700 apartments. What's more impressive is that 2,600 apartments are under construction, and 500 hotel rooms are on the way to augment the existing 123. Jobs are flowing into the area, too. Lowe's opened a global technology center in a 23-story tower in South End in 2021, a major shift from its headquarters in Mooresville. All of this created an energy that is reminiscent of Atlanta back in the 1980s, when graduates of schools such as UNC Chapel Hill and NC State University flocked there for good jobs and cold beers at the Beer Mug in Buckhead. And the energy in South End has helped vault Charlotte to number 79 in a recent list of the world's best cities by Resonance, which specifically noted the rail line. Raleigh ranked number 95, a good reminder that there's plenty of competition for high rankings and promising employees. Finally, a major development rises downtown. Quietly, a big development in downtown Raleigh is starting to take shape. The RUS bus development at the corner of Harget and West Streets is on the rise as construction goes vertical. It's one of the few large projects advancing in an interest rate environment that has strangled commercial construction. The $300 million development, which includes a new transit center for downtown, is funded in part by taxpayer funds. On the commercial side, Hoffman and Associates will build Union West, a 23-story building with 385 apartments and 20,000 square feet of retail space. The project, which had a hotel in the plans, was scaled back due to the tight financial markets. Medical facility on the way in Pinehurst. A planned $30 million medical facility in Pinehurst is about to take a major step forward. Sandstone Health and Rehabilitation, based out of the Asheville area, is planning to break ground on a 100-bed skilled nursing facility in Pinehurst on December 5. The facility will have more than 80 full-time employees. Skanska is looking to expand in Mid-Atlantic region. A global firm is creating a new region to serve the Mid-Atlantic. Skanska created a new Mid-Atlantic region to grow its building operations in North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. The firm is looking to expand its footprint and capacity in these regions. The firm performed upgrades to Durham Bulls Athletic Park in 2023. Mark Balling, Executive Vice President and General Manager for Building Operations in North Carolina and Virginia, will lead the Rockville and North Carolina, Virginia construction offices starting January 1. The combined experience and expertise in this new region will help Skanska better serve previously distinct geographies, address opportunities in the available space of this larger region, and grow an already strong presence in the region, Balling said. And finally, female founders come together to aid Western North Carolina. Four women whose businesses were largely unscathed when Hurricane Helene blew through Asheville in September have created a fundraiser for other women business owners who weren't so fortunate. Entrepreneurs Allison Blake and Alyssa Van Arnhem of Soulku, spelled S-O-U-L-K-U, Ginger Frank of Poppy Handcrafted Popcorn, and Marjeet Ragland of Plum Print created the Women Entrepreneurs Asheville Recovery Endeavor, or We Are, to provide financial aid and other support for women-owned businesses that suffered from the event. Their goal is to raise $1 million to support 20 grant recipients. We Are is seeking tax-deductible donations through the website weareasheville.org and is selling $20 raffle tickets for themed baskets valued at between $3,000 and $6,500. Raffle tickets will be available for purchase on the site from December 1st to December 15th on the weareasheville.org. And now we turn to the top news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. First one written by Kate Tracy. Juice Bar Restaurant to join Grub Project. ITB Development adds popular restaurant from Winston-Salem. A Winston-Salem restaurant is planting seeds in Raleigh. Village Juice and Kitchen will open in March at 3711 Exchange Glenwood Place, just inside the Beltline. Clyde Harris, Director of Finance for Village Juice and Kitchen, said Gordon Grubb with Grubb Ventures approached the restaurant about opening in the Glenwood Place development. He had two kids who went to Wake Forest, and they were huge fans of the concept, Harris said. Beyond its juice bar, the restaurant serves salads, grain bowls, smoothies, smoothie bowls, toasts, wraps, and more. The average pricing for menu items will range from $9 to $14, Harris said. The Glenwood Place space is 2,400 square feet. Village Juice will join other retail tenants in Glenwood Place, including the Iron Oaks, Sushiman, Quarter Note Coffee, Ladyfingers, and Flowcore. Napa at Glenwood, a wine bar and restaurant venue from Charlotte's Conway Restaurant Group, signed a lease there earlier this year, and construction is ongoing at its space. That part of town that demographically really fits our customer, it's beautiful, well-lit location that will make a great space for us, Harris said. He said the number of office buildings along Glenwood Avenue near Interstate 440 was one of the factors that made the location attractive, as Village Juice offers catering for businesses. Village Juice founder Lonnie Atkinson discovered the power of a plant-based diet when her mother was sick. When she moved back to Winston-Salem to help care for her mom, she put the whole family on a plant-based diet and started seeing immediate health benefits. It inspired her to start a business focused on nutritious foods and juices. Her husband Nathan was college roommates with Harris at Wake Forest University, and he joined the business early on. The team opened the first brick-and-mortar in 2016 in Winston-Salem. Creamery project set to start in Raleigh. Popular bars closed to make room for two towers in busy corridor. This is written by Kaylee Thompson. A major project to remake the Creamery building in Raleigh's Glenwood South is nearing construction. Two bars in the building, the Ark Royal and Pine State Public House, recently closed after New York developer Turnbridge Equities informed businesses not located in the historic portion of the building that they would lose access to their space. The effective date was November 15. Patrick Shanahan, co-owner of the Ark Royal, said he and Niall Hanley chose to close after Halloween weekend as it felt like a good way to go out despite it being a difficult time. Owners of Pine State Public House did not return requests for comment. However, the establishment is expected to be part of the new development. Turnbridge plans on starting construction in 2025. Shanahan said he was told demolition of the non-historic part of the building will begin early next year. Plans include a 37-story residential tower with 306 units, followed by a 20-story office building. Although Turnbridge has said the timing of the office building will depend on demand for space. Tenants in the historic portion of the building, the Milk Bar and Sullivan Steakhouse, won't have to vacate as that portion is being preserved. The Ark Royal opened in spring 2021 as a tiki-themed bar. It had already closed once before in September 2022, but Turnbridge faced delays in permitting that allowed the bar to reopen in March 2023. The project was unveiled in 2021 after Turnbridge paid $34.7 million for the building and two adjacent properties in 2020. Glenwood South could change dramatically in the years ahead if a number of proposed developments come to fruition. For now, the Ark Royal will not reopen anywhere else. Shanahan said that if the right opportunity comes along, the owners would explore opening another version of the bar. Trump's return worries NC Public Radio. This is written by Lauren Onasorge. The storm came swiftly in western North Carolina, knocking out cell service, internet, and power as the floodwaters were rising. But one thing Helene did not knock out was Blue Ridge Public Radio, an affiliate of National Public Radio that stayed on the air, even offering a text-only option on its website so that those who managed to get a limited signal could get essential information quickly. But with the potential for a new Trump administration to cut funding, stations are worried about the future. In North Carolina, public dollars make up a minority of public broadcasting funding, but the grants provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which allocated about $7.5 million for North Carolina in 2023, are significant. At Blue Ridge Public Radio, they represent just under 10% of the budget, says Tim Rossler, interim general manager. Several folks in Congress have literally said they'd like to defund NPR, he said, noting that what some don't realize is that while local stations purchase national programming from NPR, they do a whole lot more locally. When Hurricane Florence hit 6 years ago, Public Radio East out of New Bern was one of just two local stations available to stay on the air. Federal dollars, about 10% of the budget, are essential, General Manager Ben Donnelly said. Paul Hunton, president of WUNC, said taxpayer funding is comparatively small to many other expenditures, and then local stations amplify those funds with their own fundraising through underwriting and individual giving, creating a network of over 200 local stations providing essential news and information to their communities. Less than 5% of WUNC's funding comes from CPB. Charitable giving in North Carolina falls to 10-year low. This is written by Cameron Snipes. North Carolinians are feeling a little less generous these days. According to data released November 25 from the North Carolina Secretary of State's office, professional fundraisers raised just $27.1 million from North Carolinians between July 1, 2023 and June 30, 2024. That's a 53% drop from the year prior and the lowest total in a decade. Charities in the state netted $16.4 million in fiscal year 2023-24, resulting in 60.72% going to charities programming, a decrease of nearly 15% from the aggregate percentage charted in the previous year, according to the Charitable Solicitation and Licensing Division's annual report. The report states that national solicitation campaigns that included North Carolina citizens that were reported to the North Carolina Secretary of State's office reflected $359 million in gross receipts donated, with nearly $192 million, an aggregate percentage of 53.43, going to charities programming. That marks a 67% decrease in overall giving and a 28% drop in the aggregate percentage being netted by charities in national solicitation campaigns, the report found. Startup with Duke Ties moves beyond the NFL. Protect 3D uses advanced technology to create orthopedic devices. This is written by Lauren Onasorge. The technology starts with a clinician and a tablet. She presses go and targets the green dot on the screen at a patient's ankle. With the touch of a button, anatomy scan that can be used to create an ankle orthotic without the need for a plaster cast or modeling by a doctor. It's happening at Durham startup Protect 3D, where the measurements taken in the app are crunched into a design that is 3D printed and shipped within 48 hours. It's the brainchild of a trio of Duke University entrepreneurs and former football players. They started with elite athletes and are now shipping orthopedic devices to everyday patients. The startup has its roots at Duke, where founders Kevin Gesman, Clark Bullitt, and Tim Skapik wanted to make a 3D printed collarbone brace for an injured Duke football player, quarterback Daniel Jones. And it worked, so much so that it became Protect 3D. Within 2 years of pushing out that device, the startup won the NFL's first and future innovation challenge, which came with a $50,000 check and two Super Bowl tickets. Initially, the technology was targeted toward professional athletes, but the founder saw a broader market. The technology that allows an NFL athlete to compete at his highest level can also be used to improve the lives of the general patient population, Gesman said. The company's clinical solution allows places like Raleigh Orthopedics and Duke Health to scan patients through an app. The scans can then be printed at Protect 3D's facility in Durham. The broader orthopedic space is the next growth opportunity, Gesman said. The U.S. Department of Defense recently awarded the company a $1.3 million grant to explore how to help soldiers through custom protective devices, and the firm is in the midst of a $2 million seed financing round. St. Augs slashes half its staff to reduce costs. This is written by David Pertell. St. Augustine's University in Raleigh has taken drastic steps in an effort to keep its accreditation as the diminished school tries to survive. The historically black school, with an enrollment that has fallen to just a few hundred students, says it has cut half of its staff positions. The school, which for years has been in financial turmoil, says it has reduced expenses by approximately $17 million in its fiscal year 2024 compared to the previous year. St. Aug says the cuts are part of its efforts to ensure compliance with its accreditation agency, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, or SACSCOC. In December, the agency is set to have a hearing on the school's accreditation. The school's operating budget was around $35 million in 2022-23 academic year. In a blog post November 23rd, the school said the job cuts include eliminating 67 staff positions, 41% reduction, 37 full-time faculty positions, 67% reduction, and 32 adjunct faculty positions, 57% reduction. The school says it has also discontinued several under-enrolled programs. The school, which has faced multiple lawsuits for unpaid work and owes millions in back taxes, said it is actively settling outstanding balances with vendors while adjusting various contracts in an effort to restore financial integrity. Before the fall semester, the university received a $7 million loan from an investment group in Durham called Gothic Ventures, but it had to put up its valuable real estate, assessed at around $100 million, to secure the loan, which comes with an interest rate of 24%. The school said its agreement with Gothic would allow it to access up to $30 million. And our next article, written by Ben Tobin, Whataburger's next move, expand into Southern Pines. A popular burger chain is looking to join the busiest retail development in Moore County. Whataburger recently submitted plans with the town of Southern Pines to build a 3,305-square-foot restaurant with a drive-thru in the Morganton Park South development, a roughly 100-acre project that has brought Moore County its first Target store and will bring more big-box stores in the years ahead. It's unclear when Whataburger plans to open the restaurant, how much it plans to invest in the building, and how many employees it will hire. A representative of the company included on the application with the town of Southern Pines did not respond to requests seeking comment. Bill Mees, director of development for the company leading the Morganton Park South development, Cincinnati-based Midland Atlantic Property, said that, "As the developer of the Morganton Park South, we're very excited to have Whataburger join the project." Whataburger is in expansion mode in North Carolina, with a new store planned in Fayetteville and two in Raleigh. Century-old building in Durham gets new life. This article is written by Kate Tracy. Entrepreneurs pay $1.8 million for building, begin major overhaul. Brian Strawberry studies forecasting and trends for the construction industry as a chief economist for FMI Corporation. Now he and his wife Kelly are undertaking a construction project of their own in downtown Durham. The Strawberries purchased the century-old building at 301 East Chapel Hill Street in 2021 for $1.8 million. My wife and I are both really into older buildings, Brian Strawberry said. We live in an older house, and when we went and looked at it, we were scared because we knew it was very old and not in the best shape. But after looking at it and spending some time there, we really fell in love. The former tenants in the building were PDQ and Choice Cuts. Once their leases expired and they moved out at the end of 2023, the Strawberries started planning to renovate the building with the intent of long-term ownership, he said. The Strawberries are investing approximately $2.7 million in renovations. They purchased the building with cash and took out a construction loan for the renovations. The three-story building, back in 1910... The team behind the renovations found circus posters dating back to the early 1900s on the walls, which they are trying to incorporate into the decor in the future. It's a big piece of Durham's history, being in the downtown scene from the beginning, he said. The Strawberries hired Durham-based Alliance Architecture and Gateway Building Company for the project. Both Alliance and Gateway have experience with historical renovations. This is very much an adventure for me, and I wouldn't be willing to take on this project without a strong team I have with Alliance and Gateway, he said. Upgrades to the building include a grease trap and increased electrical and plumbing infrastructure in preparation for a potential restaurant tenant. Fuquay project will have homes, shops, offices. This is written by Kaylee Thompson. Hundreds of homes and more than 300,000 square feet of commercial space are coming to a hot community in Wake County. D.R. Horton has entered into a development agreement with the town of Fuquay Varina to develop Vaughn Park along North Judd Parkway. Vaughn Park, that's going to be spelled V-A-U-G-H-A-N, Vaughn Park, will have 742 residential units and 336,000 square feet of commercial space. The mixed-use development will be west of the town's core near the Pine Acres Community Center. The town's Board of Commissioners unanimously approved the developer agreement and rezoning on October 22. The agreement included D.R. Horton committing to prioritizing the commercial portion since the town has had issues in the past with the developers not building planned retail, according to commissioners' comments during the meeting. D.R. Horton did not respond to inquiries about the Vaughn Park project. North Judd Parkway will split the development with a 10-foot-wide path on both sides of the parkway. The east side will have 150 cottage homes, 22 townhouses, 18 row houses, and 3 commercial buildings. One of the commercial buildings will be a medical building with assisted living and office space containing 200 units across 4 stories. The west side will have 45 townhouses, 19 single-family homes, 2 multifamily buildings with 88 apartments, 6 commercial buildings and 6 mixed-use buildings with 397 apartments and 130,000 square feet of commercial space. One of the commercial buildings will be 40,000 square feet of office space in a 3-story building. The remaining 5 will have 166,000 square feet of retail space as a shopping center. Vaughn Park will be at 801, 809, 813, 817, 825, 829, and 833 Wilbon Road, and 2 unaddressed parcels also on Wilbon Road. Smithfield Warehouse sells for millions as demand rises. This article is written by Ben Tobin. A nearly 80,000 square foot building in Johnston County has sold for millions as industrial vacancy rates are falling in the fast-growing community. Kiki's Properties, an LLC with a Knightdale address, purchased a warehouse at 1517 South Brightleaf Boulevard in Smithfield for $3.5 million on November 21, according to Johnston County deed records. The seller, Brightleaf Boulevard's Properties 2, LLC, purchased the building in October 2022 for $2.5 million per deed records. Enrique de Jesus Pena, who is tied to Kiki's Properties LLC, declined to comment. The more than 78,000 square foot warehouse is vacant, according to promotional materials for the property. This acquisition comes as vacancy rates for warehouses and industrial properties are falling in Johnston County amid rising demand. Per research from real estate company Colliers for third quarter 2024, Johnston County's industrial market had a vacancy rate of just above 13%. While this is much higher than the 7% vacancy rate in the Triangle industrial market, it's a decline from 15.5% and 18.2% for Johnston County in the second and first quarters of this year, respectively. Wolf Speed gives interim CEO sweet deal. This article is written by Lauren Onisorge. As Wolf Speed seeks out a successor to Greg Lowe, who was recently fired as CEO, it's using its own down stock to incentivize its interim leader. On November 21, Wolf Speed detailed the pay package it extended to Thomas Werner, its board chair and the man tapped as interim CEO, while the company seeks out a permanent replacement. The package includes sweeteners intended to keep Werner on the board after a new CEO is hired. Werner has been on the Wolf Speed board since 2006 and chairman since 2023. He was previously executive chairman of SunPower Corporation. The offer letter Wolf Speed sent to Werner has the company paying him a base salary of $150,000 a month for his service, which now includes the executive chairman title. Wolf Speed paid Lowe an annual base salary of $875,000. But the real carrot may come in the form of the restricted stock units on the last business day of each month, which could add up if a new CEO can turn the share price around. Wolf Speed shares were down about 85% on the year. According to securities filings, those restricted stock units will value at $225,000 for each month of service as executive chair. The shares will vest on the one-year anniversary of the grant date. Quote, provided that Mr. Werner remains in continuous service with the company, including continuing service as a director following the conclusion of his service as executive chair, unquote. Lowe's total compensation was nearly $11.4 million, according to the proxy statement. Adding up just the base salary and restricted stock units, Werner could make $4.5 million, a sum that would go up significantly if the stock price rises. Number of future EV chargers at RDU debated. This article is written by Lauren Onisorge. A plan to expand Raleigh-Durham International Airport's Economy 3 lot is supposed to emphasize sustainability. But while solar panels on top of canopies and a stormwater management plan were discussed November 21 during a meeting of the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority Board, an electric vehicle component was left out of the presentation, to the chagrin of multiple board members. The parking lot expansion has become a $164 million project and will add around 8,700 additional spaces to the existing lot of more than 3,800 spaces. But approving the funds took some back and forth. Board member Nina Sosberg-Landis said she was very uncomfortable moving such a large project forward without any EV chargers. The board ultimately approved an amendment worth more than $39 million for the lot expansion, but tacked on the requirement that staff develop a proposal to include EV chargers and deliver it within 90 days. That plan should include at least 100 EV spaces, perhaps an entire EV parking lot, board member David Kushner said. Chick-fil-A finally coming to Wendell. Atlanta chain will add a location in the booming Wendell Falls community. And this article is written by Kate Tracy. Chick-fil-A is ready to plant its flag in one of the fastest growing communities in Wake County. Wendell, get ready to eat more chicken. The burgeoning Wendell Falls community will soon be adding the Atlanta chain to its list of retail options. Columbia Development Group of South Carolina purchased a lot at 2100 Treelight Way in November and has executed a lease with Chick-fil-A, according to property records. Columbia President Jenkins Williamson called Wendell Falls not only one of the fastest growing submarkets in the Triangle, but also one of the fastest growing in the Southeast. The interest in Wendell is driven by just the prolific growth in that particular segment of the Triangle, Williamson said. Right now, the nearest Chick-fil-A to Wendell is in Knightdale, but Wendell, with the popular Wendell Falls community, has been growing rapidly and amenities have followed. Columbia paid $1 million for the 1.78-acre lot. Its total assessed value is $1.4 million per Wake County deed records. An LLC associated with the real estate firm Newland a Brookfield Properties affiliate, was the seller. The site is located in the Treelight Square retail district at the corner of Wendell Falls Parkway and Douglas Falls Drive. When it comes to residential development nearby, an apartment community opened in August in Wendell Falls. Meanwhile, Brookfield Properties is building homes that will start in the low $300,000s of dollars in Wendell. And another apartment and townhome community are also in the works. Meanwhile, Columbia Development has its hands in a separate chicken restaurant as well. It's developing a Guthrie's, an Alabama chicken chain, at 2907 Wake Forest Road. Williamson said it's the first of at least 10 and as many as 20 Guthrie's coming to the Triangle, let alone the rest of the state. Columbia Development is also a development partner in Carey's Fenton. And now we'll turn to the continuing series, The 52 Shades of Success. Now it's the impact of AI. The headline on this, a common sense approach to AI. The focus is on AI literacy and developing a uniform, understandable language around how businesses discuss and disclose AI usage. And this is written by Connie Gentry. About this project, 52 Shades of Success, The Impact of AI, explores the challenges and opportunities of individuals and businesses that are trying to leverage the capabilities of artificial intelligence with an eye on combating bias and its functionality. We'll focus on AI's impact on various areas of business and life. Understanding artificial intelligence may be more about common sense than developing extensive expertise in the nuts and bolts of how it works. At least that's the approach Reggie Townsend, vice president of the data ethics practice at SAS, takes when he talks about the need for AI literacy. He likens it to the fundamental understanding we all have about electricity. Flip a switch and it works. Use it appropriately and it makes our lives easier. Use it recklessly and it can be hazardous. Chances are you started learning about electricity as a young child when someone told you, "Don't put that thing in there," Townsend said. We all have a sense for what electricity does, how it helps, but how it might also potentially harm. Because that same socket that you couldn't put an implement into is also the socket you use to plug in your iron to iron your clothes, it's important that we develop a level of AI common sense so that eventually we build a level of fluency in common vocabulary to achieve AI literacy. He points to the AI Act that the European Union put into place in August, which calls out the need for AI literacy. The AI Act requires those developing and using AI to ensure, quote, a sufficient level of AI literacy of their staff and other persons dealing with the operational and use of AI systems on their behalf, taking into account their technical knowledge, experience, education, and training, and the context the AI systems are to be used in, and considering the persons or groups of persons on whom the AI systems are to be used. Townsend supports the idea that those using AI should invest in AI literacy, but adds, I also think that governments have a responsibility in this regard. We can't leave it all up to employers because employers are understandably going to talk about AI from the vantage point of their business. They're going to train you on their utilization, but we need a more fundamental level of understanding. One of the challenges is that AI literacy is lacking even among corporate leadership. A Deloitte survey of some 500 C-level executives and board members found that, as of this summer, 45% said AI had never been discussed at any of their board meetings. More than three-quarters of them, 79%, said their board had limited, minimal, or no knowledge of AI. Yet 44% also said that their organization should accelerate progress with AI. I'm leaning into the literacy piece. Now it's really important to get people fluent, establish that common vocabulary, Townsend said, circling back to his earlier analogy where most people are content with a basic understanding of electricity, while others became engineers or physicists. He said, I think the same will be true here. You're going to have people who advance their fluency and become data scientists and AI researchers, and then there will be business folks who are using AI and just need to appreciate some of the nuances of the technology before they implement it. Increasingly, he sees organizations that are establishing some version of a governance committee or internal council to focus specifically on how to implement AI across their enterprise. At SAS, Townsend chairs the AI Oversight Committee, which considers every aspect of AI from what they buy to what they sell. In our particular case, as a provider of AI, we have to think about the product development lifecycle and ask ourselves some questions that press us to think about possible downsides, possible harms, and we have to think about maintaining compliance expectations in places like Europe now that there's the AI Act in place, he said. Similarly, we're a company that is implementing AI to help improve the productivity of our employees, and so we had to think long and hard and do a lot of pilot testing, and we decided to adopt Copilot from Microsoft. Since launching on February 7, 2023, Microsoft reports Copilot has been downloaded around 27 million times and has roughly 28 million active users. Even before Copilot was available, SAS was encouraging its associates to consider AI tools outside of the organization, but with the caveat that they were doing so without using SAS data. We were keenly aware of how models get trained using data, so we stressed, don't put our data out into the public sphere, Townsend noted. We started encouraging our employees to use AI broadly a couple of years ago, and we put in place an internal AI policy, which effectively says, here are the guardrails, this is the so-called playpen, so you can have at it, but know that there are potential repercussions and consequences associated with the use of AI. Before AI literacy can be embraced, businesses also have to address the lingering sci-fi perception that, as Townsend describes it, painted the technology as the Terminator. AI is relatively multimodal at this point, but that wasn't always the case. It used to be that every time you saw AI in the movies, it was hunting someone. The Hollywood strand and the scientific strand have come to combine themselves in the popular psyche, and employers have to deal with that psyche. We have to educate folks on what AI is and what it isn't, how it can and should be used, and how it shouldn't. That's the broader conversation about AI literacy, and my point is that we need to give people the opportunity to make informed decisions. In his estimation, literacy and governance are the two areas that businesses should hone in on to leverage AI most effectively with an eye to specificity. The discussion should include how specific types of AI show up in specific types of use cases, because that's where either the help or the harm might occur. In general, the advice Townsend gives to clients is to look for the proven use cases where we know how it works, as well as repetitive or laborious tasks where it would be more useful to have AI perform the functions. And as we're running out of time, we will not have time to read the executive voice that focused on Catherine Hoover, the president and CEO of the Nautical Group. Catherine Hoover, born and raised in North Carolina, Catherine Hoover jokes that she fell into recruiting by accident, starting as a temporary employee at the Manpower Group early in her career, and she now runs the Nautical Group as its president and CEO. Hoover is in charge of recruiting executives for a number of clients in the Triangle and beyond, and serves as a key conduit between businesses and that need a fresh face and those looking for a new opportunity. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.